Welcome to Mormons on Mushrooms. In this podcast, we discuss alternative methods for healing from trauma and seeking a fulfilling life. We often discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. In addition, the opinions offered by our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts of this podcast. If you'd like to support the program, please visit www.patreon.com/Mormons on Mushrooms. Thank you for listening and enjoy.
How was that?
Well, it was my first time, and I think since she left on her mission, so almost 2 years that I've been in a church. Before that, it had been 6 or 7 years. It was an interesting experience. I had a good time.
Are they, my perception of kind of the chatter around people going to and fro is that things are like back to normal, or people seem unaware that there's a pandemic. So what was the attendance like? Is it normal?
Well, so they had the video set up, you know, and people had like a YouTube. I think they do. It's interesting. They do sacrament meeting on YouTube, but then they do like priesthood and relief society or Sunday school via Zoom. So there's like interaction and stuff like that. But at the thing we went to today is down in Salt Lake. It was like every other row was empty, like every other pew. And then, you know, everybody was wearing a mask except for the speaker. I had an interesting experience. I'd love to share my experience if you guys want to hear it.
I think we should.
I don't know.
I hit record. Is that cool?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to mention any names, but, I was having some like, I was getting all tight. I was getting like, you know, because I'm with my in-laws. Everybody's very Mormon, and it's my niece that's come back from her mission. And, you know, my family is the odd group out. And so we're kind of like dealt with kind of almost like with delicate gloves. There's this interesting experience where my wife's family, like they'll cuss and they'll have kind of like conversations that, you know, are maybe not great for mixed company, or, you know, they're a little bit rambunctious that way. They were talking about a Murder Among the Mormons show on Netflix, you know?
Yeah.
But it's interesting because in that same vein, I was glad I didn't bring up or really participate in the Murder Among the Mormons conversation. And anytime I swear or say anything, it's like, oh, it's so sad that he's so influenced by the adversary. And it's so sad that he's like this fallen, used to be real Mormon and all that kind of stuff. But for them to do it, it's like this inside joke. It's like, you know, nobody can make fun of my brother but me type of deal, you know? Uh-huh. And so I was going into sacrament meeting with sort of that hanging over me. You know, I got to be, you know, Johnny Reverent and be really like, oh, I'm here for it, you know, whatever it is. But also I had the judgment meter running. And then I was like, you know what, before we start, why don't you just turn off the judgment meter and just be here and just enjoy yourself and just see what you can maybe even learn, you know, have a good time. And it worked incredibly. I had an enjoyable, you know, the speeches were really good. And about halfway through my niece's homecoming speech, I was like, oh, you know what? I'm not mad at Mormons. I love what they're doing. I love their community feel. And, you know, she's up there, she's 20 years old, and she's just like, oh, everything is based in love and turn to love and love one another. And, you know, follow, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of Jesus thrown in there and a lot of Joseph Smith and that kind of stuff. And that's great. But I was like, oh, you know what? The things that make us similar are so much more than the things that divide us. And the only things that I'm annoyed by is the power structures of the church, the business side of the church, the history of the church, the patriarchy is really what I'm annoyed by. Here's my niece giving this great talk, and it's all about love, and it's all about, you know, reaching out and giving hope to other people. And I was just floored. I was like, oh yeah, they don't care about you know, my niece doesn't care about the history of the church, and she didn't care about you know, my problems with the power structure. She just cares about the same fucking thing that the four of us care about, mm-hmm. which is building a community, bringing love into the world, being more open-hearted and accepting people as they are and all that kind of stuff. And there's almost like this weird sense of those of us who are the way we are, we put them in this weird thing because of the truth claims, because of the only true and living church on the face of the planet claims, because then they're stuck with this thing of like, I love Doug. Doug's awesome. He's funny. He's friendly. He's fun to be around. He's really interested in what he asks me a lot of questions about what's going on in my life. Yet he's an apostate and I have to like keep that in the back of my mind. And I was feeling so sorry for them. I was like, oh my God, no, you don't need to work. You don't need to handle me with kid gloves. You can say what you want to say about the church. You can bear your testimonies. You can have prayers and let me get involved and let me say a prayer. Let me say amen, all that kind of stuff. It was like a really good thing for me when I turned off my judgment recorder, my judgment meter in my brain. And I was just like, oh, I think everyone's just doing their best and trying to make their way into happiness and love. And we are all kidnapping victims. We are all Stockholm syndrome victims of this larger machine that is trying to control something. And I was like, oh yeah, I love everybody in here. Everybody in here is just doing their goddamn best and having a great time. And they like it. It works for them and they love it. And I'm like, hell yeah, keep doing it. I'm going to go do mushrooms. You guys do this and we're going to be on the same page.
Maybe not quite the same page, but close.
I mean, yeah, not the same. Yeah. I don't think they would have liked me talking about Pleiadians and like my roots of, alien life forms and stuff like that. But you know what? If I had said, we come from near Kolob and we are the star stuff and we are intelligence that has existed before the universe was created, they'd have been like, fuck yeah, go Doug. Meanwhile, I'm just like, same, but the old dudes downtown don't get to say anything about me drinking a hard kombucha. That's the only difference. Anyway.
Well, and this makes me wish you were on this one with Glenn even more, Doug. This is what we dove into is the similarities between, like Pleiadians and Kolob and all of that. But it worked out what was supposed to work. But I think there is something to that, because I find that when I'm with my active member family or friends, I spend so much time seeing myself through how I think they're perceiving me. You know, yes. Like,
wow. Well said.
Yeah. Like I already come with this thing of like, cause I know how I would have perceived me in their shoes. Mm-hmm. So I come with that predetermined judgment, and then I'm projecting that judgment onto them through them. And so like, it's almost like I expect that from them. And so it's like, I feel like I'm creating that when I'm with them.
It's important to understand where that's coming from. And we come by it honestly, but that is a defense mechanism. That is you bracing in advance for the bad thing that might happen. So if it does, you're not getting hit out of left field. It's not coming unawares. And so Doug, I'm hearing you say that essentially that for you, that defense mechanism today wasn't necessary. There was no need to go through that exercise because the thing that you were afraid of happening never happened.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. And my kids took the sacrament, and I'm like, okay, take it. They're passing around the sacrament, take the sacrament. And then afterwards, one of my in-laws was telling a story about how she had gone to mass with her Catholic friend, and her friend's mother got really upset with her for taking communion, because that act of taking communion as a non-Catholic would damn her, would forever put her in limbo or whatever it was, whatever the thing was. And I was like, oh, you know what? We are just trying to carve out, all of us, we're just trying to carve out like, okay, well, what is my identity? What makes me me, and how am I different than everybody? And what's different about me? And we come up with rules, and we come up with like a set of, whether it be commandments or doctrines or personal mottos and creeds and stuff like that. But I was like, no, everybody is just like kind of uncomfortable and kind of like wants to approach someone else and talk to them a little bit and get to know them and wants to let them know their true heart and wants to love them, but is nervous that they'll get rejected by that or nervous that they'll get shot down. And so it was like, not to quote your dream that you texted us, Shalice, but I was like, oh, just by being like actively going around and introducing myself to people I didn't know at this thing. And, you know, there's a luncheon afterwards. And so I'm like going up to people. I'm like, oh, it's great. It's great to meet you. And who are you? And they just opened up to me in a huge way. And I was like, wow, I feel like I've become the thing I always wanted to be, which was loving and fearless. And it took me dropping the things that made me feel unworthy of love and full of fear. And that was just all my own bullshit, all my own shit. And I can't blame Mormonism for it because they're all dealing with it the same way every one of us is dealing with it. And it took me being like, okay, enough of your crap, dude. Just like go up to people and just say, hey, what's up? I'm Doug. And let's be like temporarily best friends for 5 minutes and eat our Cheetos. And then I'll move on to the next thing and you could do the same. And then there's this like cool energy going around everybody. And everybody's like, oh, wow, man, feel the spirit. And I'm like, fuck yeah, we feel the spirit. Same. Anyway, we probably ought to cut a lot of that like long. We don't need to start our podcast with me doing a long thing. But I just was, I was been brimming to tell the three of you about this while I drove. I pulled up 8 minutes ago. 18 minutes ago. I was so excited to tell you guys about like, oh, I just had a major growth thing, like a major shift where I was like, whoa, I wasn't even like high or doing yoga or doing meditation. I just was sitting in a sacrament meeting chapel going, oh yeah, this is pretty awesome. I love everybody.
I love it.
This pops up from time to time on the podcast community a lot. The idea that people are essentially saying the same things over and over again. The books are all saying the same things over and over again, just in slightly different language because like the words aren't there sometimes. But it strikes me as in those moments when people are really being present with whatever is happening right now, that's when it's most likely to occur. When we're not bringing all the baggage and history and structure and all that stuff with us, that's when those purest moments happen, when everybody is really feeling the same things. They just might describe it a little bit differently. And it's just another language. It's the words that we have, none of which are probably accurate, but they're the best we can do, right? And so, yeah, so seeing the similarities rather than the differences is such an exciting shift.
Oh, it gives me chills just thinking back to it. We all want to hear, I find you to be a valuable creature, and I hope you also value me, and let's base this in love. And we're going to be fine. And that, and everything else, all of the insecurities, all of the what coulds or what could happen or what ifs or, imagining someone telling me off or imagine someone trying to get into a doctrine argument with me. None of that happens. It's just like, oh, no, you're valuable. And I recognize that in you. Thank you. And everybody's like, whoa, wait a minute. I can be loved. Okay. This person's fine to talk to. I don't care if they believe in Joseph Smith and we're Baptist. I don't care. I just want them to keep telling me that I'm worthy of love. Oh man. Anyway, I'm brimming right now. I'm sorry, but I'm brimming.
No, I can see it. You're glowing.
I love it.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm glad we mentioned those, like, you know, cause we talk a lot about different books that we're reading on the podcast. And, my mate and I were talking the other day, and I guess I can say her name now. She's been on the podcast. So Audrey and I were talking, and
yeah, that's a big one.
That's a big one. Right. And we were just laughing at all these books we're reading. Right. And she just started a new one this week, and it all comes down to presence, but we need these different techniques or tools or different insights to get us back there. So it's like, each of these techniques are all the different books, and whether that is the Book of Mormon for some people, maybe, you know, or something that helps them feel present and in the moment of where they're at. Great. You know, I guess. Yeah. But you seem super present today.
I'm feeling super present. Thanks. Yeah. Okay. Should we just like, shift like gears and be like, what up? Let's do a Peter and Shalice episode and really give some love to the world.
I don't know.
And I'm excited about this one because the one we had with you, Peter, before, I don't think Shalice was on that one, right?
No, she was.
Oh, she was.
No, yeah. I was.
Oh, you were. I listened to it today. I listened to it today on my drive and I was like, damn, Peter and Shalice are going to be a heavy hitter today. This is going to be good.
So good.
I'm excited for some callbacks to that one, actually. That's going to be fun.
I got nothing but callbacks. Yeah. Peter, I've been memorizing it. I'm ready.
But, well, I mean, I think we can introduce you as our producer extraordinaire now, right? Our, how do we, our
Oh, yeah. Supreme, no, keep going. I'm here for it. Come on.
Yeah.
Supreme master producer,
chancellor, overlord, mastermind.
Yeah.
You know,
grand architect.
Yeah. I help out behind the scenes on, some of the logistical stuff on the podcast. It's a lot of fun.
And a great rap. Facebook moderator.
Oh, bless your heart.
So, yeah, I mean, I think with this one, and maybe you guys can chime in a little bit more on what you're wanting to talk about, but I think we wanted to get a little bit more back to basics. You know, we get a lot of questions about, you know, how do I find a community, or how do I find, I'm being called to plant medicine, and where do I find it? What do I do on my first trip? What, it's just a lot of kind of basic questions. And I think it'd be good to have an episode that when we get those questions, we can just point people to it and just say, check out episode number, whatever. I mean, is that what we were wanting to do today?
That was the original idea that I floated, and that was a few months ago, and it took a while to schedule this one just because life and stuff was going on. And I think that's a valuable idea. But what every podcast seems to have happen is that it's a good place to start, and then it veers off in all kinds of fun directions, which I'm also excited about.
Yeah.
The idea of essentially, Doug, what you were just talking about is almost that back to basics, in a sense that it needs the almost full circle route around a lot of the complex kind of discussions that we have around these topics to essentially get back to this, almost the starting point. And Ram Dass, his first book is called Be Here Now. It's this big square book. It's blue. It's relatively well known in sort of the hippie book spheres. Essentially, that's one of his big central premises, is that the journey of the sadhana is really starting from this place of needing something more, doing this huge complex loop around and ending up right back in the same place that you were with, Doug, essentially what you just said. Nothing's different, but everything's different. I'm just present in the moment. And so I want to lay that kind of down as a foundation, that there can be a lot of really complex discussions about the physical mechanics of how to get involved in a psychedelic experience and integrating from it and all of the stuff that comes with that. But eventually at some point that seems to fade into the background almost. And it's this haul water, chop wood. The psychedelic experience leads to deeply profound experiences while folding laundry or washing dishes. That is a sign or a signal to me in my own experience that I've started to get it the way I think I wanted to get it, but could never have articulated it. But I want to just be able to live my life in a deeply present, deeply profound way that would allow me to have, Doug, your experience. And I had something similar today. My wife was in Zoom church. I was, I don't know, doing the dishes or something. And she texted me and said, hey, so-and-so blessed their baby today, finally, because there had been a delay because of COVID. They blessed their baby today, and it was this really cool, awesome experience. And my reaction was, that's amazing. I wouldn't have had that reaction a year ago or 2 years ago. The stuff that we've left behind that no longer serves, there's that cliche, right? Drop or release what no longer serves. This is the result. That very simple, basic presence in these day-to-day things that don't have all that baggage being dragged along with to cause the triggering reactions or the pain or the frustration or the anger anymore. You can just be in that, even in a church, in a place that would have driven you out of your mind one time, mm-hmm. or driven me out crazy to have anybody talk about anything to do with baby blessings, and be just like, that's great. I'm so happy for them. That's awesome.
Oh man.
I love that.
So in terms of the mechanics of what is a basic approach to how to have a psychedelic experience, one of the things that I've done kind of in the coaching practice that I do on the side is I created this survey that I sent out to a lot of different people. And I asked, what do you wish you'd known before you started? Because a lot of the work that we're doing at this point, each of the four of us are a couple of years into these experiences. And I think it can be hard to remember almost what that first experience was like. So I'd love to kind of start there. What are some things that, as you reflect on what your first experience or two were like, what do you think you would have done differently if you'd known then what you know now?
Oh, that's a really good question. Anyone have an immediate start on that?
So this will be the first callback to Peter, the episode that we first met you and talked to you. But it's hard for me to answer that question because looking back at my first psychedelic experience, I wouldn't have been coming down from being drunk at Whiskey Street. I would have done more preparation as far as the intention behind it. I would have wanted to maybe even skip a meal or two to, you know, fast to put myself into a mental state for that. And I think all of that is very important. I do that now. But if it hadn't happened the way it happened, then I probably wouldn't be what I am right now. I wouldn't be where I am. I would be somewhere else. That's totally great. And I'd probably be somewhere even better, maybe. But I like where I'm at right now. And so it's almost like, you know, that call to adventure, wherever it hits you. And I think taking psychedelics is an adventure. That's the first thing. I think it is the same way you would like, okay, I'm going on a quest. I'm going on a journey. I'm going on an adventure. You'd want to prepare for it. Sometimes it's just thrust upon you, but it's about listening and hearing that call to adventure and saying yes and saying, okay, this is where it, you know, because we get asked a lot of time, well, where do you get this stuff, or where, how do I find it, or how do I find the right communities? And it's like, we keep telling people and nobody ever believes us, but then the people who do this, it happens to them. It's like, just be open to it. Just send that out to the universe, send that intention out, and suddenly you'll find it every turn, and you'll have to turn down opportunities, and you'll have to tell people, oh, I can't make it this weekend, or oh, I can't do this tonight, or I can't do that, whatever. So it's hard to answer that question. I know we're trying to do like a, okay, the beginner's guide to how to do this stuff. But I was a very bad beginner and loved my experience, Mike, with you under the moon at the reggae festival after when we were kind of hung over from drinking whiskey for the last 4 hours, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my bad answer.
That's a good answer.
That's an awesome answer. And that's really important because we can't change the past. We can only learn from it. But if somebody were to come up to you and say, they described, here's what I'm going to do, and they described the way your first experience came out, would you necessarily in advance let them know, okay, that's perfectly fine, go and get drunk first and then go and do mushrooms and then do this and then do that? Probably not. But those things will work out the way they need to. But there is a certain amount of preparation, I think, that is reasonable for people to put in, or a certain amount of awareness or basic knowledge that people can educate themselves on of essentially what's going to happen physically before they go. Because even if you change nothing, if you had known a little bit more about what to expect, would that have made a difference?
Maybe that's where I can jump in. Because my first journey was incredibly curated and incredibly prepared for. I mean, I was at a facility in the jungle where everything down to our meals were literally handed to us. Like, this is when you eat and this is when you don't. And my first experience, as we know, nothing really happened because I had so many expectations and put so much weight on the experience because of all the preparation that I was kind of just stuck in my head. And when I finally kind of shot off was in the second ceremony, when I just let go and said, okay, whatever happens, happens. Granted, there was still a level of preparation, but my mindset wasn't stuck in the preparation. It was really present. And I think that's what I would tell people, is do the necessary preparations, set a space, a container of space that's safe. Tell people you're going to go off the grid for a couple hours or have someone there with you, watching you, helping you, facilitating. But then also put yourself in a mindset of, I have these intentions, but wherever the medicine takes me is perfect. Or I have these intentions, but I might not get what I want. Or I have these intentions. Basically, go back to intentions rather than expectations, because I think expectations can really color your experience or take you in a different direction. And it may make you upset if you don't have a certain experience than you were expecting.
I like that you said expectations. I mean, intentions versus expectations. And I still get caught up in that. You know, I'll go into a certain ceremony with a specific intention, but really what I have is an expectation. And I feel like for the first hour or so of the trip, it's kind of beating that expectation out of me until I finally surrender to the experience. And Doug, I'm glad you mentioned our first one, because it turned out how it needed to, but we needed some like universe intervention to get us there. I mean, we got drunk and high at a fantasy football draft. We went to Whiskey Street, had some more drinks. And then the universe was like, nope, you're going up to the reggae festival. We had the mushrooms. And I don't know if we were just going to gobble them up at the Red Lion in downtown Salt Lake. I don't know what our plan was.
I think that was kind of like our plan. And then it was like, no, magic. First of all, rule number one, magic is real and the universe is listening. So put that down as the rules, you know, put that down in our book. But yeah, Peter, I'd be interested to know how you answer this question, because you are very, you know, logic and reason kind of are the things that you sort of like yin and yang with some of this more woo-woo stuff, some of the more transcendent stuff that you experience when you know, using those substances. So I'd be interested to hear you answer your own question.
I am, for clarity's sake, I am here for the woo. I will talk about ninth dimensional Pleiadians all day. I love it.
Yes.
My what you're describing is essentially my approach, my vocabulary that I use. I am more naturally adept to use, I guess, call it almost the language of Western medicine, the psychopharmacology aspect to this. So when I think about intention versus expectation, for example, an expectation would be there's some kind of measurable result where I know that I got what I wanted or got what I asked for, or I didn't. It happened or I didn't. An example from a book that we've all read is that if I set my intention to be that I'm going to get a particular car, and it's going to be a particular color, and it's going to be a particular model, and it's going to smell like this, if I don't get exactly that thing, then my expectation is not met. But if instead we go in with, I think, what is a better description of an intention, I am looking for what the emotional response is if X, Y, or Z thing happens. My understanding is that if I had financial independence, it would feel like this. And so we're saying, well, the financial independence could be an expectation. It's not really the financial independence that I want. It's the feelings that will come from it. So if those feelings come some other way, was the expectation met? No. Was the intention met? Maybe yes. A lot of when people talk about manifesting, that's the same kind of approach. What is it that having or not having something that we want to change in our life feels like? And then however those emotions come doesn't necessarily matter as much. So in terms of how I'd essentially answer what would I have done differently in my first experience, I didn't know anything really going in. I thought I knew a little bit about the biochemistry of what happens, but nothing can really prepare somebody for the experience of what 5 grams of mushrooms are like. I would have probably involved my wife more. I don't necessarily have, at the time I didn't have a really great set of communication skills. And so I, in the place I was at in my life, which was not necessarily a good place, went off and did something that was, I thought, helpful for me, but I didn't necessarily involve her the way that I should have. So the people that are closest to you, if you're going to go do something that's potentially life-changing, I would talk to them and involve them, because that energy of, if you're hiding or you're being deceptive or you're worried about what somebody's going to think, that's going to come in to the experience. I was also very fortunate in that mine was also highly curated. It was at a retreat center. There was a group of people there. It was all very logistically well organized. And what I took from that is that there is a value in having, not necessarily over preparing myself, but having people that can help me prepare and do a lot of that back-end logistical stuff so that I don't have to worry about it. The way that I describe it to individual people is trying to frame your physical surroundings, your physical circumstances, and make them as predictable as possible so that your mind and your emotions are free to go off and have an adventure. You're not worrying about, say, if you're alone, is the stove on? What if the doorbell rings? What if my phone rings? What do I do? You've got person or people there with you to help take care of the physical side of things, get you a blanket, get you to the bathroom if you need to. That I had, and it was extraordinarily helpful in letting go. So I personally didn't do enough preparation if I was going in and doing it myself, but because there were a lot of people there with me who had already done that work, I didn't need to. And it helped me learn a lot about what I personally need about a physical space in order to be able to let go and not fight the experience.
Oh man. That's important. Cause you say, you know, I mean, we're going on an internal journey with these things, right? And there's an element of making sure the external is kind of taken care of to where you can go on that journey. You feel safe going on that journey. I remember one of my first ones, this is maybe a year after, the one we were talking about, Doug, I was really in it for, and this is the first time I was like the first one we did, I don't know what our dose was, Doug. I think it was pretty mild maybe, but I don't remember getting visuals on that first one. Second one, I would close my eyes and all of a sudden just intense visuals would happen. And I felt myself being transported out of my body whenever I'd close my eyes. Then I'd open my eyes and I'd be back on Earth around, we were around a fire, on the beach. And our friend who was there, our shaman, was, he could see what I was going through. He could see, like, and whenever I closed my eyes, I'd go on a journey. And he said, "Mike, it's okay. I'm watching your body. Go on the journey. I'm watching your body." And just hearing him say that, I'm like, okay. And then I could surrender to it. But I think there was something about the proximity to the fire and, you know, just being like, if I close my eyes and go on this journey, I don't know where I'm going to end up. So just him saying it's okay and he's watching my body, then I was able to go on that journey.
I have to second that, because that just reminded me of my first mushroom experience where I was with just one other person and he also did the mushrooms, and we probably should have had a third party kind of like checking in on both of us because at one point we hiked to, why, I don't know, but like we hiked to this hill out in the middle of Joshua Tree. It's pitch black, like no one's there. Somehow, like we basically peaked on that mountaintop and I was just out of my mind. Somehow we make it back to the Airbnb and I was like, time was gone. It was totally an illusion. And I was like, I get it now. But I kept opening my eyes and looking at him like, where are we? He's like, we're in the Airbnb. Are you sure though? Because I think we might still be on the mountaintop. And I was so worried all night that I was actually still up there and I was going to get like eaten by a coyote or something. But that was really important to have that person to kind of anchor me in, because it's true. Every time I closed my eyes, I was literally everywhere else but where my physical body was. And I kept checking in to make sure.
Yeah. I think it's important to say that in both those experiences, neither was right or wrong. They're very different. I think outside of, am I physically safe? Like, am I going to wander out into traffic? Within the bounds of anything other than that, it's just an experience and it is what it is. The likelihood of something going in an undesired or unpleasant direction, I think, increases when the number of things that are unpredictable around us increase. The more that is predictable, the less likely that is to happen. Not to say it won't happen. Like, you're going to have if somebody's going to have a bad trip / difficult experience, that's not necessarily going to not happen because you're in the most controlled physical setting. You never can know what's going to happen in an experience, but it's less likely. And I think physical safety, when we're talking about this kind of thing, is the most important thing.
Yeah, I really like have an intention but not an expectation, because even if I look back at my what I described as a bad story, which Mike was our first you know, foray into psychedelics. That might have worked in our favor because we had both talked about, you know, we had kind of read up on and done some digging ourselves about like, oh, we want to try this thing, you know, that people do, the mushrooms. But I don't think either of us had an expectation. I mean, the proof's in the pudding. We didn't know what to expect. So we were planning on being drunk and adding that to our evening. You know, we had smoked weed, we had drank whiskey, and then we were just going to like see where the night took us from there with these substances. So we had no expectation. And I think a lot of times people go into it with the expectation of like, oh, I want to know what Shalice is talking about with these, you know, ninth dimensional Pleiadians, or I want to see some of the like, you know, visuals or imagery that I've heard people talking about, or I want to see colors and hear music differently. And all these things that, you know, maybe are kind of cliche. So if you go into it with all these expectations and those aren't met, then that can lead to kind of a weird experience and a weird trip or even a weird post trip feeling about how it went, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you go into it with some intention of, well, I want to have this experience and I want to see what it opens up in me, or the impact that it has on me, or the effect that it has on me. You don't have to worry about, you know, am I having some real aha moments? Am I digging into my historical DNA roots and working out trauma? Am I seeing little elves run around everywhere? You don't need to worry about, these are the things that I kind of like jotted down that I want to happen, and then they don't happen, so I'm disappointed. I think it's about going into it with the intention of, okay, this is a new and different way to explore parts of myself, to explore not only how this impacts my body, but also how it impacts my brain, my imagination, all that kind of stuff. And if you go into it with that of just saying, oh, what's this going to be like? I'd like to explore. Then you will. you for sure will, right? Who knows how it'll manifest itself? Every experience is different. All four of us have had very different experiences with how it impacts us. But I love, Shalice, that you said it's about intention, eliminate expectations. Love that.
Well, I'm also glad that you brought up comparing experiences. I have had a lot of people reach out and say, I want an experience like yours. But the funny thing is, even within my 7 ayahuasca ceremonies that I did, not a single one was the same. So I can't even go in saying, I want an experience like mine or like that second ceremony, because the medicine always gives you what you need, not really what you want. And so some people don't see anything ever. Some people just hear music. Some people just feel feelings. And that all goes back to the different clairs, clairsentient, clairaudient, all of those. You can kind of understand your gifts more too by what the medicine gives you. But I think it is really important to, if you are the type to research like I did and like, well, what do people experience, and you want to read everything, that's great. But just know that that doesn't mean that's the experience you're going to have. You're going to have the experience that the medicine has set aside for you.
And there's an interesting flip side to the idea of expectations versus intentions, which is the things that people don't want to have happen. And the people in my experience who have done, Shalice, a lot of that research side, it's coming from a place of really being afraid of not being in control of the experience. Yes. They're wanting desperately to understand everything that might happen so they can brace themselves and be prepared, because they've heard this, that, or the other anecdotal story through 50 years of the war on drugs about these bad trips or these things that might want to happen. So if I prepare more, if I research, if I learn everything, then I can prevent those unpleasant experiences from happening. Those are the fun conversations to me when I'm talking to people on the, here's the expectation side. I want to see this, or I want to feel this, or I want to have whatever. I'll go under that and I'll say, well, why? What is it that you think experiencing that is going to give you? What is it that you think you're going to feel by having that? And then play with, again, with the car analogy. What is the feeling that you're wanting to get? That's the intention. And then conversely, if somebody's really researching and a little bit apprehensive about, yeah, I want to go and do this and I'm going to have my first experience, but I'm really afraid of what I've read about, you know, going down staircases and opening doors and seeing monsters and the advice of go down the stairs and open the door and shake the hand of the monster, I don't really want to experience that because I don't think I can handle it. It's a very fair, honest place to come and, I guess, arrive at the conversation of what might happen. But let's go underneath that. What is it that you don't want to feel? Well, I don't want to feel fear. I don't want to forget who I am. I don't want to feel like I'm going to die. Well, why? And I keep pushing and I go, why? And more often than not, it comes down to control. I don't want to feel out of control. They're already kind of okay, but not necessarily completely okay with the physical loss of control, that particularly at high dosages where you're going to have trouble walking, you probably can't trust your eyes very much if you're trying to navigate around a room or go to the bathroom. But it's that internal sense of, I don't know what's going to happen and I'm afraid I won't be in control. I'm afraid I'll do things that the people around me will find upsetting. I'm afraid that I will see something that I won't be able to deal with. Those are very, very different conversations, but I think they kind of arrive at the same place. You have a safe physical surrounding. You have people that you trust. You have comfortable clothes. You have a blanket. You know where you are. Somebody's watching the door. Somebody's got your phone. There's music playing. You've got snacks if you need them. You've got water. That container, that space is going to increasingly make it feel more safe to go in and say, all right, I can trust the process now. I don't have to worry about this fear and if a coyote is going to eat me on top of a mountain. I can just focus on what I'm doing. So I'm very curious about what has come in for you guys in that other angle of what are the things that you didn't want to have happen when you went in?
I think first I just want to say I love the idea of the control thing because that's probably baseline for 90% of the people. And that was a baseline for me too, having never even had alcohol before. And then going into ayahuasca, it was really scary to be like, what's it going to feel like to not be in control? Is this what it feels like to be drunk? But that's the same type of thing as I was having these expectations of what it would feel like to be out of control. And so I stifled myself. And I just went back and listened to that episode after we talked to Glenn for some inserts. And same thing like with Doug, and please excuse me for bringing this back up, but both of us had talked about, we were 100% sure we were going to crap our pants. And you had said something that the moment you realized you hadn't, you let go and you were back into the experience again. And I think it's because you were able to release control. And that's such an important part of doing plant medicine is, yes, you do need to relinquish control because that's where the magic is. And it sounds scary, but once you do it, it's just incredible and it's so worth it. And so releasing control, yes, I understand it 100%. It is terrifying in some ways, but that's where the transformation occurs.
And it's not unique to Mormonism, but I think there is a layer on top of generalized Western culture's loss of control where, at least in my experience, there was a pervasive sense through most of my life that I can't let go of the control of the mask or the facade, because if people knew what I really was like or what I really thought or what I really felt, something bad would happen. I had to wear the mask all the time. And so I had gone through my whole life really feeling like, no, I can't let go of control ever. And that sort of amplified, I think, a general cultural sense that we have in the West of not being able to really give up control, rugged individualism. I don't know, maybe it's tied into that. But being able to go into a space, I think at a dosage where it wasn't really my choice at a certain point, I didn't have control if I ever did. And then the illusion of control was pulled out from under that as well. And so went from this place of, I am afraid to give up control because I really don't want to. Why don't I want to? Because I don't know what it's going to be like because I've never done it before. To then, oh, okay, this is what it feels like to really, really let go, to really, really not be in control. This isn't what I thought. And it just confirmed for me this thing that I run through a lot in my own life, in my head or with other people, is the fear of the thing is almost universally, almost always not as bad as the thing.
Right.
Oh, yeah. The fear of the thing is worse than the thing. But it takes that lived experience enough times to do it. So if I had gone into my first experience in an environment where I didn't feel like the physical surroundings were predictable enough. I don't know that I could have gotten to that place. I think it would have been more unpleasant. So while I recognize that everybody's experience is unique and I'm not going to tell somebody the right way or the wrong way to do it, I would strongly recommend matching your dosage with your physical surroundings. If you're going to go for a walk in nature, which is awesome on lower dosages, absolutely. If you're going to take 5 grams and say we're going to walk around on a mountain with coyotes in the middle of the night, I don't know that I'd recommend that necessarily. I mean, go with God, have at it, but it's probably not going to be as good an experience as you think it's going to be.
Go with God. I love it.
I mean, well, really, you're going with yourself, so go with God. Yeah.
Yeah. But what great, like, learning just for life, and maybe this is what one of the values of psychedelics is, you're getting in a contained experience the lesson of we don't know what to expect in our life either, and how much of our suffering is trying to curate an experience or recreate an experience. You know, think of like wanting today, like having a great day and being like, oh, I want today just to be like yesterday. Well, it's not going to be. No matter how hard you try, no matter how much effort you put into it, it's just not going to be the same. And how much of our lives are, and our disappointments and our pain and our suffering are from expectations and those expectations not being met. And so what this psychedelic experience kind of shows you is in a container for a 4 hour or however long the experience is going to be, just an intense container to feel through that, and how when you surrender to the present moment, how everything becomes beautiful, everything opens up. And, you know, I've even thought about it just recently in dates, like when Audrey and I go on dates or something, you know, occasionally we'll have like a really awesome date night. Like, oh yeah, let's recreate that. Well, we can't, you know, and if we try, it's not going to go well, because instead of trying to recreate that, I mean, that's a mini thing, you know, a date night, but I think it's a good example of what can happen when we're trying to recreate or control the situation rather than just like, hey, let's just be and see what happens, you know? And that can be scary, but.
Yeah. And that attempt to recreate is the internal dialogue is something like, if I can recreate this, I can guarantee that I will experience those same pleasant things again. If I don't control it, there's a chance those might not happen. And it's very interesting to me how my own narrative tends to go in that pattern. And it's not saying, okay, if I don't recreate that, something so amazing that I never could have predicted might happen. Why is that not the default behavior? I would like that to be the case a lot more, but it's a self protection mechanism. We don't want to be hurt.
Yeah. I think we keep talking about the concept of control. There's the different levels of what we even are maybe even talking about. You know, I think a lot of people, when they say, well, I just don't like the idea of being out of control. Everyone's experience is different, but I'll tell you, I don't like coming out of like an anesthetic, like if I've had surgery or something like that. I get really worried because then people tell stories to me about things that I was saying or doing when I was coming out of that anesthetic. So that's what I think about when I think of losing control. I've been black. I hate getting drunk. That's going to be a weird thing for people to hear as often as I talk about being drunk. What I mean by that is I've been blackout drunk, and that's a scary experience. Being blackout drunk is a scary experience because the next day, not only do you feel like shit, you have big gaps in your memory of what happened, and who knows what people can say. Oh, you said this, you did this, you were out here, you were running in traffic, you were doing this dance move and it was terrible. And everybody thought, and you thought you were the greatest dancer in the world. Like that's a really uncomfortable loss of control. And so I, you know, even though as much as I joke about drinking and stuff like that, I really don't like to be like, I'm happy to get buzzed or tipsy, but I don't like to go into a place where I'm drunk. Now, when it comes to like mushrooms, you know, LSD, that kind of thing, DMT, there's a very different definition of losing control. Peter, you were talking about you don't think maybe your feet can work to walk you from one room to the next to grab a blanket. that you're just like, I just don't think that can happen. I just don't think it's going to happen. You know, it's I don't know that I can say words that are going to make sense to these people that are sitting around me. I feel like I could speak like a different language, this language of whatever realm I'm in right now. I feel like I can speak clearly in that realm, but I don't think that I could put together a coherent sentence right now. That's a difference of control. DMT, you know, the ayahuasca, that's, you know, Mike, you were there with me. I'm laying there being lowered into my own graves over and over again. And I'm observing it as a witness, as someone who's there watching and being like, oh, that guy's dead. And that the guy that we're talking about is me. And I'm like, yep. Yeah, I thought I'd be a lot more, you know, bummed out about my own death than I am here. But I can remember, I can tell these stories. I can talk about the experience that I had. I can talk about like ego death. I can talk about blast off and then there's just nothing. I didn't exist. But you still have some level of awareness of like, that's what happened to me. You know, that's what I was dealing with. Weed's the same way. You can get really high and say some really funny things, but you're always kind of like aware of what you're doing and what you're saying, stuff like that. And so it's like a different, even the concept of like, oh, I don't want to lose control. Yeah, same. I'm not into getting, into that like post anesthetic, you know, weird hangover where you're, you know, talking about your friend who's really tall and can jump high and saying weird things you don't want to be saying, you know, or when you're super blackout drunk and you're doing those dance moves that you're convinced are the best dance moves. I don't remember those dance moves. I wish I could if they sound like they were great dance moves, but I can't remember them. You know, people just tell me about them. So I think it's important to talk about like these different, I think that you said it, the fear of the thing is much more than the actual thing. In really, if I could give people life advice, the fear of a thing is always worse than the real thing, because the real thing just happens and you're like, okay, well, I got to deal with it. It's happening. Yeah. So how am I going to deal with it?
And So you can think of it like a roller coaster almost. Roller coasters are scary. Some people are terrified to go on roller coasters. Roller coasters have safety mechanisms built into them to keep you safe so that you can have the scary experience and be relatively confident that nothing bad is going to happen. Still terrifying, but you know you're supported by the seatbelt and the thing on your shoulders. And so in your guys' ayahuasca experience, I think, and Shalice as well, the people that were surrounding you, the people that had done this, they knew the procedure. They knew what to expect. They aren't caught off guard when someone starts throwing up because they know what's happening. They are ready and prepared and have put measures in place to keep you safe so that when one is being lowered into one's own grave, there is still a sense of this is okay. This is scary and maybe not what I was expecting, but I know it's going to be okay because of everything else around me that was prepared to get me to this place.
Man,
I'm glad you brought up the analogy of the roller coaster, because that's one that's come up a lot for me lately, including in dreams. I have dreams of roller coasters all the time. And I love that, because you have to surrender to that roller coaster. You know, the only way you're going to probably get hurt is if you try to jump off the thing, or if you're resisting it, or if you're resisting against that lap bar, or if you're just like, you know, fighting against that experience. But that experience can be scary. And once you're on that roller coaster and it starts moving, there's no getting off of it.
Nope. And there are two characteristic things that are universal, no matter where in the world you go, no matter what culture you come from. There are two things that are identifiable for people that are enjoying a roller coaster as it was intended to be enjoyed. They scream and they hold their hands up or their arms up in the air. They let go of that bar. They do not hold on. They let go and they embrace the experience. And then they scream. They're having an emotional response and they let it out. And I can't think of a more perfect way right now to describe how to kind of get the most of the experience. But if you're on a roller coaster where you're thinking like, this seatbelt's a little wonky, and does that noise sound right? Are you as likely to be able to let go and put your arms up in the air and scream like you're having the best time ever? Probably not. So the container and the practicalities of I have blanket and I have a path to the bathroom, these are not just keep my physical body safe so I don't wander into traffic. These are intentionally set up so that you have that freedom to let go of the bar of the roller coaster and scream and have the best time, because you're not worried about whether you're going to be safe or not.
Oh my gosh. As we're talking about this, I'm thinking of a thing about like also in both roller coasters and these experiences we're talking about with psychedelics. Look at the engineer who engineered this, right? Cause like if I'm getting on a roller coaster at like the mall parking lot, like semi-annual, like, you know,
fair
carny that comes through. Yeah. And I look at the dude and he's like methed out skinny guy with like a Def Leppard t-shirt on. And he's like smoking a cigarette and you wouldn't trust him to like drive you to the front entrance of the mall, let alone put together this fucking roller coaster that you're about to get on. Right. Yeah. But meanwhile, if I go to Disneyland or Lagoon or Six Flags or something like that, I mean, they got millions of people coming in there. They got safety protocols up the wazoo. They got people testing this stuff. So that's the same thing with psychedelics. Like if you know, the guy you went to high school with and didn't really know, but he's friends of a friend of a friend, and he, you know, he deals, you know, pot and coke and meth and heroin, and you find out, oh, maybe I could get some mushrooms from this guy. That's probably not going to be a great time. Like that's probably something you can't trust. Meanwhile, if you find, you know, some, you know, witch who's into yoga and always does like a dance video on Instagram and works at a crystal shop and is really into like talking about her zodiac sign and her feelings and who she is, I feel like I'm going to take her mushrooms. Like that girl knows how she's going to like get me taken care of, because she only wants me to have the safest, most incredible experience of my life. So look to the engineer is another. I'm doing this on the fly because I thought about it. I was talking about the roller, you know, putting your hands up on the roller coaster. I was like, I'm not putting my hands up on the roller coaster at the mall. I'm not doing it, you know, at the zipper where people are like, oh, you know, you go win a fucking big old teddy bear and also maybe close to die on a roller coaster.
And if she's infusing that the mushrooms with anything, it's probably with cacao or rose or something that's going to open the experience up. It's not going to be laced with some other sketchy stuff.
They're like songs. Like she's probably like cooking them up in a vat, and it's probably a Tibetan singing bowl. And she's probably like, you know, chanting, you know, spells into your mushrooms. Yeah. You're gonna have a fucking great time if that's who you're dealing with. But if you go to like, you know, behind the Denny's and you know, a guy who used to go to high school with you and be like, hey, did you get a bag of mushrooms? I'm not taking those mushrooms.
The unfortunate part, I think, about our culture is that that is often the only option people have, because for lots of reasons, we don't have a culture of elders or a culture of shamans or people to help us. Like every time people talk about shamans in a psychedelic experience, generally they're talking about people from South America that either still live there or have brought that practice back to North America. We don't have it. And it's so frustrating. Because how much different would the last 50 years have been if the direction was get the research that was happening at Harvard and Johns Hopkins in the 60s, keep going with that. And those people who were doing underground work are celebrated and they're teaching other people. And we build or rebuild a culture of elders and shaman in the West that didn't come over from Europe because, well, we killed them all. The equivalent now, it strikes me, and I could be wrong about this because we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, we don't call them elders or shamans here. I think we call them coaches. I think the role that coaches play in a variety of different aspects, whether it's sports or life coaching or anything, it's people who have had much more experience in the area of X, Y, or Z thing that they're coaching someone else on. And whether someone has had 1 hour more experience than me, they know something that I don't. And so I think it behooves me to pay attention and listen to them. I feel like sometimes we are doing work in the podcast and in this community to try and speak the language of people who have had a particular religious experience, but to say we are sometimes blindly fumbling around in the dark, trying stuff in an effort to gain some wisdom that we can then share with other people to help them navigate similar experiences a little bit more elegantly than maybe we did and with less unnecessary suffering than we might have experienced. So going back to the original question, what would you have done differently? If you hadn't had those experiences the way you did, you wouldn't be able to have the perspective of, okay, maybe these weren't the ideal circumstances that I would recommend to somebody else. We don't have the benefit of having generations of people who have had these experiences, at least not people that are either readily available or willing to talk about it in a way that we would consider a North American shaman. And that's what this work to me feels like, is we're building that. And that contributes to building trust, to helping people feel safe in a space, physically and emotionally and mentally, to go in and let go of that bar. You can have all kinds of fun experience on the sketchy roller coaster in the parking lot. Like, I have lots of cool memories about traveling carnivals at the town I grew up in, little town, right? They're awesome. They're a lot of fun. But going to something like Lagoon or Disney World after having that experience, it doesn't compare. Yep. Because the people that built it knew what they were doing, and they learned from the people who built it before them, and they built on top of everybody else's stuff. We are at the lower ground level of that work now, trying to figure this out to help people to have better experiences than we had.
Man.
One of the things that kind of comes up for me when I'm thinking about what I would have liked to have known before, and this is just a life lesson in general, but that healing isn't linear. Oh, you know, yeah. When I did my first mushroom experience, and I've talked about it before on the podcast and other podcasts, how I felt like my soul snapped back into place that night. It was really easy for me after that experience was over to be like, well, you know, if my depression comes back up, or if I'm having a bad day, to really get hard on myself for it. And it still happens. I mean, this last week was a pretty rough week for me. And I think an element of healing is you kind of get to a good spot, and then your body kind of says, well, here's another thing we can heal from. And it brings that up. And so in those moments, it's really easy to feel like all of this work you've been doing, or this psychedelic experience you had, has been for naught. And it's really easy to get in your head about it. But healing is a very two steps forward, one step back process. And it even might feel like two steps back or three steps back sometimes. And that's okay. And that's part of it. You know, one of the questions I get from a lot of listeners when they reach out, especially listeners who are used to SSRIs, is they'll ask, now, how many doses do I need of this? Is it one and done? Do I need booster doses? You know, thinking about it in a very Western medicine type way, where the drug is basically the healing. But what you realize, it's the experience that you have on it that's the healing process. And what you'll find, I feel like, is that, yeah, that's not a linear experience. And it's not you have to kind of change your mind about booster doses, or this thing that like, oh, if I take mushrooms once, I want something I'll take once and never have to take again, because I'll be fixed, I'll be whole. And the thing is we're already whole, you know, but I've kind of lost my train of thought there. And maybe some.
No, you got it. I mean, you're the conditioning of Western medicine has definitely made it like Advil. Take pill, get better. Mm. I have a headache, I take Advil, it goes away. The way that I've described this to people now who are seeking it for that particular modality is the first thing I'll say is disclaimer. I am not a mental health professional. I am not a credentialed psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor, anything. So don't ask me for that kind of advice, anybody. And so once that caveat is out of the way, I'll say, based on my own experience, the 4 or 5 hours that you might have in a particularly compelling psychedelic experience could be considered a side effect. That is a necessary gate to go through in order to get to the point where you have the tools and the messaging now that you need to go and do the work, to do the healing that comes after. That it is entirely possible to have a deeply powerful, well-curated, well-supervised, organized psychedelic experience once and never need to do it again for the rest of your life. That is absolutely possible. Everybody's path is different. Some people don't react that way. I think that I would have gotten a lot of benefit out of the one that I had. And if I had never done it again, I would have been in a much better place afterwards. I think it made a dent in what I experienced. And personally, I needed to go back to that place to learn things that I didn't pull up the first time, as well as to learn, oddly enough, that I didn't need to go back to that place to learn things. And so I change the conversation a lot when I talk to people who are seeking it for this reason and say, if that was a side effect, well, what is the real effect? it is the meditation practice that often gets developed. It is the mindfulness. It is journaling. It is art. It is music. Walking in nature. Those to me are the things, if we're looking for stuff to do, those are the things that bring healing. And the integration side of this is probably a whole other episode and conversation. But going in expecting, again, expectations, right? I expect this experience to be this, and I expect to be healed. If you come out of an experience like that with your expectations not met, that could be almost even more damaging than before you went in, and if you had not done it at all, simply because of how much people seem to hang their hats on things from a desperation point of view. I mean, that's where I was when I went into my first experience. I was coming off, I had been on SSRIs for 20 something years, and I was desperate to find something that was different, that I just wanted to not feel this way anymore. And when that didn't happen quite the way I expected, it could have been very easy for me to be pushed off a precipice and say, well, this didn't do what I expected, therefore nothing's going to work, therefore why bother? I'm glad it didn't go that way. And I credit my wife with being extraordinarily patient with me through a hellish period, to the degree now that when I talk to people who are looking at it coming in from that space, I'm like, this is maybe not the right time for you to do this. Let's have a lot of conversations first. Let's talk about whether you're seeing a therapist or a psychologist. Let's talk about what the mechanics and basics are about preparation, so that you can be cognizant of what your expectations are and that they may not necessarily be met the way you expect. Let's go underneath what you're talking about in conjunction with whatever mental health care professional you need to work with.
It's a really important direction to go when we're talking about doing it for the first time, because in my opinion, plant medicine shouldn't be used as prescriptive. Like we were saying, it shouldn't be, well, I have all this depression, and so I'm going to go do plant medicine to get rid of the depression, and it's going to be one and done. I'm going to be fixed, and that's the experience I want. But plant medicine isn't a cure. In my opinion, plant medicine simply offers a new perspective to allow you to do the healing yourself. And like you guys are saying, with the meditation or the integration is where the healing happens. The plant medicine simply shows you another lens in which to look at your trauma or your depression or whatever it is you're facing, and gives you the opportunity to face it in a different way, to maybe feel through it, to maybe release it. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're just fixed all of a sudden. It just gives you the right path to go, to the right path to lead you to the healing.
And that concept, how foreign a concept is that coming from a religious culture layered onto sort of the North American culture of looking externally for things to fix problems. In the spiritual context, looking to God or a priesthood leader or repentance or something that is always external, not going inward, not trusting yourself, not believing that the answer is hidden underneath a bunch of layers of, I don't know, trauma. It's not that we're not educated in how to do the work. It's that we're looking in completely the wrong direction sometimes. It's such a foreign concept out of the gate that it's hard for people to wrap their head around. What does it mean to do an inward journey? What does it mean to find the path into yourself? If I had heard that as an active member, that would have sounded insane to me. I can't go into myself. That's the source of the problem. Why would I go there? I have to go out externally to these other sources that if I pray just right, if I fulfill my calling just right, then I'll get the answers that I need. I didn't have any concept of that. And how many people coming into this work are coming from the same place? How do you teach something that in other cultures is just basic from childhood? That, yeah, our greatest teacher is ourselves. We have to go inward to our journey and not be beholden to external authorities who don't necessarily have our best interests in mind. Like, how do you, I don't have a good way of explaining that to people yet, I don't think.
Well, it's that whole check the box mentality. And I was in that, you know, I mean, when the same experience I was talking about on the beach, leaving that experience, it was the best I'd felt ever up to that point in my life. And that carried over for the next couple of weeks. And then I had another experience which put me in a funk. And I think because I'd felt that high, or maybe not even the high, but that that connection to myself that I'd never felt before, and then to feel that disconnected again, it was a big low, thinking what, and then, you know, the story kept repeating, like, what am I doing here? You know, I think these plant medicine, it's going to help me, and I'm doing all these things, and I'm really just broken. But it was through that experience that led me to my therapist, a good coach in a way, to really help me start to integrate these experiences. And I'm glad you mentioned, I know integration could be a whole other episode, but seeking help in integrating these experiences, whether it's a wise friend, but I would even recommend a coach. And I know coaching has a stigma in our society, but you're seeing it more and more, the value of that now, especially as we transition in our economy to more of a, I just think there's a value in learning from people who, like you said, might know a little bit more about it, even if it's just a little bit. But really, I credit having a coach, a therapist in this case, but a therapist who is very open to helping me integrate these psychedelic experiences, open to help me explore my subconscious, open to, you know, I feel like I can talk to her about anything, you know, with, if I go and do ayahuasca, like, well, I don't know what her opinion is fully on ayahuasca, but she's more than happy to help me integrate it. And really, really work with it and work with the images that came up and work with whatever I'm going through. And that's when I really feel like, and you know, someone to talk to when I'm like, this doesn't feel like it's working right now. And she's like, well, what do you mean? You know, and dig into the fear of that. What fear is coming up for you there? You know, and then help put things in perspective and say, okay, just look back at where you were 2 years ago. And look where you are now, you know, especially during these low moments when they come, is incredibly valuable to do that.
Doug?
It's probably, yeah, I was going to say, it's probably my turn to talk, but I am really soaking in this conversation. In fact, I feel right for the last few minutes, I've just felt like this would be great. I hope I'm just a listener to what the three of you are talking about. I don't know. I'm having like a minor, maybe like a minor revelation right now that I've been sort of circling around for the last few weeks. And it comes down to, yeah, I mean, it just comes down to some of the things that I've talked about both on the podcast and offline with a few of you, of just, you know, we already mentioned the fear of a thing is oftentimes worse than the thing. And we talked about some of these things, you know, Mike, about two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes you feel like you're two steps back, another three steps back, you know. But I'm kind of having this revelation of no matter what imagery we use about like, you know, digging deep, maybe removing a little, you know, chiseling loose a little bit of something, or, you know, Peter, you've talked about wet clay, you're scratching at a wall of wet clay, you know, and it's all about this, like this constant motion or this need to get to the next place or to improve the thing that exists currently to be better and more enlightened and, you know, just more awesome and available the next time you face that same like sort of stimuli. But I'm kind of sitting here going, well, hold on a second here. Instead of zooming out, I think a lot of times we talk about zooming out. I just zoom out, you know, maybe you're feeling this way the last couple of weeks, zoom out. How about the last couple of months? I'm sitting here going, well, what if I just zoomed in to now? What if I always just zoomed in to right now? That makes the worst things that have ever happened in my 40 years. They take up about, you know, a grand total of about 15 minutes total. Of like, just that thing, the worst thing. I'm talking, you know, you all know. A month ago, my youngest was on the verge of death, you know, and I got a little emotional even just saying that. But from the moment we were in the depths of that, every moment after that was good news. It was, oh, he's doing well here, and he's having this kind of improvement. Same with my job. I get all stressed out about very specific and certain things that could happen in my job. But it's like, oh, what happens 2 weeks from now? What happens 2 months from now? What happens 2 years from now? What's going to happen if this happens? Oh, what about that thing that happened a few months ago we're still dealing with? And I'm sitting here going, what if instead of always telling myself to zoom out, what if once in a while I checked in and zoomed in and said, how are you right now? How are you? And most of the time in my life, I have to be honest. Most of the time I would be like, great, thank you. I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Mm-hmm. Unless and you're currently like, being eaten by a coyote, which is very few and far between.
Yeah, I'm not currently in grave danger. And you know what? That can change. In a week, I could be in grave danger. In a week, I could lose my job. You know, whatever it might be. And, you know, even then I could get into like, what do we really value? And, you know, who cares about all kinds of, but we do care. We fucking care. It's good. We should care.
Yeah.
But I'm sitting here just thinking, man, how are you right now? And right now I'm talking to three people I absolutely love and adore. And I'm just, and in fact, I'm just for a while there, I was just listening to the three of you.
I know.
And I did that. I zoomed in and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm doing really well. Thank you. I'm really fucking killing it and happy. And this is nice. And I love it. And so I don't know. I had it for a second there. It was kind of zipping around in my head. I had this tiny little revelation where I was like, you don't always have to look at the big picture. Sometimes you can just look at the right now picture and carry on. And it's totally okay. It's totally fine. Things are going to be fine. And if they're not fine, then they'll get really shitty and then they'll kind of get fine again. And then you'll maybe die. Maybe if you die, maybe things will be fine.
Doug, what you're describing is a very easy to understand and digestible version of Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, which is like, I listened to that book over and over. I still haven't finished it. Like I'll listen to it and I'll start over and then I'll get like halfway and I'll start over. That it's like 8 hours on Audible of mind blown talking about just finding your center and being present, which is again, the basis of doing plant medicine is being present, relinquishing control and understanding that in this moment, you're probably fine and stop projecting yourself into a future moment that you're just creating in your head that doesn't even exist and stop projecting yourself into a past moment of something that doesn't even exist. Just bring all of those versions of you to this very present moment and take inventory there.
Oh,
love that.
Love that. There is also a sort of a practical angle to that as well. The teachings that we have in the church about how humans are somehow on the top of a pyramid or the food chain of the animal kingdom, that we are not animals, that we are different. It separates us from being able to understand from a physiological perspective what happens in animals when they're getting chased by a coyote. All these chemicals amp up so that they can run and they can get away and they can get safe. And if you ever watch an animal that has run away from something, when they're safe, what they do is they stop and they look around and then they shake themselves violently to release the rest of those chemicals. And then they go on with their day. Physiologically, what's happening to us when we're worried about X, Y, or Z thing coming up is it's the same reaction as if we were worried about getting attacked by a bear or a coyote. But because we're not getting attacked by coyotes, our brain says, well, I got to come up with something that might be a threat. So we imagine things that might be a threat one day so that we're always ready. We're always on guard. We'll always be safe. If we understand just even a little bit of the basics of biology and physiology, and the book Sapiens has been really good for this by Noah Harari.
I'm about to quote Sapiens. Keep going, but I'm about to quote it. Yeah.
Yes. I'm excited.
Just having a very, very high level basic understanding of biological evolution and recognizing that we are so similar to the animals that we are able to observe, we can learn so much from that behavior. We can learn that if we just stop and go for it, maybe we shake, but that's dancing, that's walking, that is going to work out at the gym. It's the same physiology happening. It's the same chemical changes going on to relieve stress, to get out of that fear or that flight response and into a place of centeredness. If you watch a cat or a dog in your house, they're not worrying about what's coming 5 minutes from now. They're always right here, right now, in the present moment, always, because they don't have that same illusory concept of time, Shalice, that you're talking about. They can remember things in the past for the purpose of keeping them safe, knowing when they're going to get food, knowing when they're going to get affection, but they're always right now. I want to snuggle now. I don't want to snuggle now. I'm going to bite you now. I don't want to bite you now. But then 5 minutes later, it's over. It's done. And we can learn so much from that.
It's like we used to be third on the list. Top of the food chain was the predators. They would go in and kill the gazelle, eat the meat. Next on the list was the scavengers. They'd go pick at the bones, get the hard to get meat, the dark meat, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then we were third on the list. We would take what we could get, you know. And then someone at some point, 15,000, 12,000 years ago, was like, what if we worked together and we sharpened these bones and attached a rock to them and we fucking killed the gazelle ourselves? And no one's been happy since. We were like, okay, well, all right, now we got to try to find more power and more ways to kill each other and kill animals and kill the earth and do our thing to stay at the top of the food chain. When really, when we were at the third place of the food chain, we were doing just fine. We were like, well, this seems okay. I think it's fine. But then some asshole was like, I think that if we work together as a unit, we can create farms and cattle and weapons. And everybody was like,
probably an Anunnaki asshole, right?
It was the Anunnaki.
Sorry, Shalice.
The Anunnaki were like, all right, you guys, you probably could just do all this stuff and you can be real powerful. And we were like, thank you. We enjoy the power. And we're going to be really fucking bummed about it for the rest of eternity. We're bummed about this power. Thanks for nothing. We got all these weapons and farms and cattle, and now we're pissed.
Oh, sorry that we were vibing on the same space there, Shalice. And
totally. I was like, I could tell you who that asshole was. It was the Anunnaki. That's a whole other episode that I've been wanting to do for a long time.
But that alien's name? I don't have a punchline to that.
Oh, but Peter, I'm glad you mentioned that whole thing. And I'm glad we're talking about this because, you know, even in this podcast, it's still very cerebral advice we're giving, you know, and how to be here now and how to sit with it. But the reality is Doug, when you're saying zoom into now, when you do that, you'll probably have a physiological response to that in some way. You know, fear will come up. Your heart rate might increase. Something might happen. When you're on the roller coaster, your heart rate's going to beat fast and you're going to want to, but then like Peter was saying, scream, yell it out, sound it out, move it out. You know, I've had experiences lately at night where, you know, my insomnia hasn't been nearly as bad as it used to be because instead of, like you were saying, Peter, trying to attach a story to what I'm feeling, I'm doing so much better at feeling into my body in those moments and being like, oh, my spine is kind of buzzing right now. Oh. Let me take some deep breaths, do some stretches. You know, I'm just a fucking monkey with shoes. And so I just need to like calm this nervous system down, do some breathing exercises, get out of the story in my head and into my body. And typically when that happens, you know, I'm able to fall asleep after a while. You know, not every night, but like, there's just, and that ties back into the psychedelic experience we're talking about. Having someone to help you, guide you to be in your body as you're taking that journey and feel into your body, feel into where you're feeling it, is invaluable.
Sleep meditation is real. And that's like pretty much what I did to finally get myself into my first actual ayahuasca ceremony was that chakra balancing meditation, because it commands presence. Any type of meditation, that's really all it is commanding presence. I prefer dancing because it's the most fun, but you can't really dance and dance well if you're not present, because you need to know where your feet are going, where your arms are going. So anything that makes you zoom in on the present moment is perfect thing to start off a journey with.
So Shalice, when you're watching somebody dance, how long does it take you to tell whether they are working through a routine in their brain and they're trying to reproduce the steps versus they're dancing?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Yeah. It's like
I think it's fairly simple to tell because of their eyes. You can see the expression in their eyes. If there's like a fake smile, you kind of know like, oh, this is manufactured. They've figured out the steps. They're just putting on a performance. But when someone is like really present and in the moment and making it up as they go, you can just see the joy in their eyes because it's, you're experiencing creation in the moment. You're watching them channel and create and express all at the same time.
So that's not dissimilar, Mike, from what you're saying about your breathing. It's the same basic thing. You're just being present in what's going on. So you guys have mentioned how you play guitar. I play guitar too. When that spot hits and you're like, I don't even know what's happening. I'm just doing it. And music is coming out. That's when I play, quote unquote, my best, because I'm not trying to. That's, if I had to sum up kind of what we've been getting at for an hour and a half, it's that. It's these experiences help us to see that that way of being is possible. Some people can get it in other ways, whether it's experiencing nature or they randomly come upon meditation. You don't need psychedelics to get there. I did. I think a lot of people who are listening to this episode or have listened to other episodes or are participating in the community, their particular circumstances led them to, that was the thing that they need to see that there is a different way of being from the life that they had experienced up to that point. To recognize that even though I can't necessarily do it yet, I can see that it's a possibility that I had no idea even existed. And when I talk about preparation, when I talk about intention setting and set and setting and all the things that people can do before they go into a first experience, all of this stuff that we've been talking about is why I think that preparation is important and why working with somebody who has done it before is important, because you can bring all this in and it can be brought back to one kernel, which is what you said, Mike. It's okay if you feel like you're dying. We're going to take care of you. Because you can distill it down to that one moment of being present, because all this other stuff has taken place around you. And without that preparation, without somebody knowing what they're doing, that is less likely to occur. And what more beautiful thing is it to sit with somebody who's clearly struggling and say, it's okay for you to die. We're going to take care of you. When you feel like you have no idea what you're going to be when you come out of that. There's nothing more beautiful than that.
Amen.
And as you
said, amen. I just want to give him an amen.
Oh, amen. As you were talking, Peter, this was coming up for me and it just made me think, when you're playing the guitar and when you're really in the zone, I think something that could aid in that, being in that specific headspace, is lack of judgment. Same with when someone is dancing in the moment versus going off of choreography. There's a lack of judgment there. It's just pure neutral. It's just whatever happens, happens, and you accept it. And I think that's also really helpful in journeys, rather than having judgment about what you're seeing or feeling, just let it be and just come from a neutral heart space, centered place, because that's when a lot of the growth happens. I think so often we stunt ourselves when we're like, oh, this is scary. I shouldn't be feeling this way. Or Doug, maybe when you saw your grave, you're like, should I be feeling differently? Like, why am I not freaking out about this? But you can come from a neutral place and then have a totally different experience.
Oh.
When we were talking about dancing, I was thinking about the movie Black Swan. Do you guys remember that movie? Yeah.
Oh,
that movie was not what I was expecting it to be when I went into it.
No, but I actually rewatched it a little while ago because I was having dreams about black swans. And so I'm like, I have to watch this movie. But it was a good one for me to watch because it was coming up when I was like, you know, all this, you know, a month or two ago when all this missionary stuff was coming back up and the perfectionism. And you think of the choreographed of the white swan and how everything's, it's all perfection and all about, you know, mastering that role. But to embody the black swan is the opposite. It's all about your intuition and flowing and being in the moment and being present. And I think, especially for us that grew up in a very Mormon culture with perfectionism, I mean, we know the white swan well. and it's the black swan, but it's also the black swan that's a little scary when she comes out, you know?
Now that you've done that work, now that you are aware of what even being present is, and you can sit in that space more comfortably, what is it like to sit with people who maybe, like, I guess, Doug, going in and being where you're at now, interacting with those people who don't necessarily understand because they've never been exposed to it, the things that we're talking about? I can almost guarantee that there was some kind of energy or vibe that you were giving off that was probably putting them at ease, not making them anxious. So just by sitting in the space with people, not even doing anything, just being in that space and being raw and vulnerable and authentic has an osmosis effect. How can it not?
Just to add to that, before today, I thought I made up a whole story about people that had that feeling about being, you know, so there's that idea of like, oh, that person puts off a really good vibe. And whatever the words we use to say that, right? Good vibe, good energy, good spirit, good positivity, whatever. Before today, I thought that people feeling that around me who were Mormon, I was like, yeah, they're going to have to try to, you know, square that circle with like, oh, they know that I'm this sinner. They know I've left the church. And why do they feel good around me? I've thought that. I will admit to being having that kind of narcissism. But as of right now, and I want to hold this. I don't know if I can, but right now I'm feeling it. Right now and today, I was like, well, who cares? Who cares that they need, like, let them feel. And because then they add to it and they're like, oh yeah, I want to open up a little bit and I want to shine a little bit of my light and I want to get in on this. And they can call it the Spirit of God. They can call it the light of Christ. They can call it whatever they want for all I care. As long as it's just like, oh, we have this kind of cool human connection that makes us feel better in the now with each other than we do worrying about walking up and talking to each other or what each other is doing, or then we worry about what happened after the fact where we're replaying the conversation. What could I have said differently? What could I have done differently? How could I better express myself? Look, who cares? They can call me. They can say that I've got the light of Christ and I'm going to say, hell yeah, brother, that thank you. I'm glad I do. I hope so. Jesus is awesome. I hope I have a little bit of the light of Christ.
He's a shitty carpenter, but
yeah, he's no good at carpentry based on the footage I've seen from my dreams. He's no good at carpentry, but that dude knows how to like galvanize and unite some people. Like that guy knows how to make people be like, oh, someone cared enough about me to do it in Gethsemane and then do it on Golgotha and do it on the cross. Like someone cared enough about me to do all that stuff. No wonder they love Jesus. I love Jesus just based on those three things. Like if someone was willing to do that stuff, that person deserves a very special place in our heart. And if they're telling me I got the light of Christ, thank you. I couldn't be more complimented. Thank you so much for that. Who cares what we use to describe that wavelength that we're all on? We all use different words. We all use different lingo. Some of it's based in music. Some of it's based in dancing. Some of it's based in fucking who knows. But we all know what we're talking about, which is that feeling of connection, that feeling of like, oh, when I'm talking to these three folks, I feel better than when I'm not talking to these three folks. Well, okay, thank you. The light of Christ or, you know, Spirit of Buddha or, you know, Allahu Akbar. I don't care. Great. Thank you. I love it all.
Well, I love that so much, Doug. And I think one of the things, touching on what Peter said when he asked you the question too.
I know, I didn't really answer the questions.
No, you think you did, but I wanted to highlight it. I'm yes anding you here, is what I feel like you offered today was presence to people, you know? And I think there's a magic to next time you're in a group of people or in a situation where maybe you feel like you're projecting or you're in your head, stop. Take some deep breaths and just think, all I need to do is offer the people in this room my presence. That's all. And see how it changes the energy of the room. And I forget this all the time, but there's a magic that happens when you just like offer people your presence. The energy of the room shifts, like the conversation shifts, people are more engaged, and you realize, oh, I didn't have to like think about, oh, what do I need to say to this? Or how can I do this? Just offer them your presence. And then when they start offering it back to you too, I think that's where magic can happen, you guys.
And it's not just in the random meetings, like those church things. Like I've been married for almost 23 years. And just this week, my wife and I sit down and we have a conversation about some stuff that are a result of getting married as young as we did, working through some stuff that we just weren't developed enough as humans to deal with way back in the day. So we're working through some stuff, and it's a great process, but I had this breakthrough moment where I heard her in a way that I hadn't heard her before. And I saw her in a way that I hadn't seen her before. And I sat with it, and we were able to have one of the most in-depth, honest, authentic, vulnerable conversations that we've ever had, because these are skills that we never had the opportunity to develop. The church structure that our particular flavor of the church structure and the branches and the wards and the stakes that we grew up in didn't allow for that. So we're having this amazing conversation, but I didn't do anything. I just had some kind of flash that put me in a place of, I can just be present and hear her. And it gave her what she needed to be able to talk, which gave me what I needed to be able to talk. And instead of triggering each other back and forth, like sometimes happens, now we were reinforcing this, okay, we can talk about this stuff. It's safe to talk about this just by being there and by being present. The days that I get, I don't know, the most stuff done at work or the most stuff done around the house, I don't do anything. I'm just trying to be a little bit more mindful. It's the times when I try and do things that nothing works, and I get frustrated and I get annoyed and expectations don't get met. The ability to, and I think this is something that I would consider a skill. The skill or the ability to stop and pause and have these kind of reflections and practice them and develop them like a muscle causes these things to happen in my life more and more and more frequently, to the degree where I'm like, much as I speak in sort of pseudoscientific language, ninth degree Pleiadians are looking out for me, and it's kind of awesome. I love the marriage of the woo aspect, because those are the best words we can come up with to describe something that other colloquialisms don't touch yet. The marriage of that with the rooted, grounded practicalities of how do I prepare for an experience with somebody who has had them already, who can speak in these terms that we're talking about now. How can I work with somebody like that to get to the place that they're at, so I in turn can go and help somebody else? That blows my mind. My wife has taught me so much, and I know I keep talking about her, but I mentioned this before the show. I've done a lot of podcast episodes where I've talked about this stuff and my journey, my experience, and I've always deliberately left her out because it's not my place to tell her story. So I haven't mentioned it, but I wanted to specifically highlight that if we call back to that last episode that I did, where I talked about how I took 3 months off work and I was not in a place to be present. I was not healthy. I was not able to work. I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. She ran the house. She looked after the kids. She did so much just by being present with me, to allow me the space and the opportunity, scary and terrifying as it must have been to see me like that, to give me the space to go and do that. She's never touched psychedelics in her life. It's not her thing. Awesome. But she, in just the way she is, created that container and that space for me to go through the process that I need to do to get to where I am today and feel safe. It blows my mind. We're talking about months and months and months of consistent, just solid, reliable love. And I get all excited about the potential of working with people in a couple of hours. The love I have for that woman, I cannot properly express. So dude, what if was you're listening it like, to this dear, there you go.
What was it like for her? Like when you're talking about like, oh, I've looked at her a million times, never saw her. I've listened to her a billion times, never heard her. You're talking about like, oh, I'm hearing her. What was it like for her? Like, tell that side of it. I know you don't want to give her secrets away, but like that had to be something for her too.
It looked, from my perspective, it looked like there was a weight that had been let off. There was a sense of, I don't have to hold up the guard. We can have a conversation that's a little bit more vulnerable maybe than we've had before. And we can cut some of this out. But having that glimpse, that moment, that flash, and that's enlightenment to me, having these flashes of deep presence and the power that comes from deep presence, that would not have happened if she had not created that space for me over an extended period of time to do the work that got me where I am today and even having this conversation.
It's really beautiful. And it's another way, what both you and Mike were talking about, it's another way of holding space. I mean, we talk about holding space all the time. And I know there's been questions in the Facebook group, like, what does that actually mean? It's exactly what you just described. It's just about being present for somebody else, not even offering anecdotes to whatever it is they're going on about, not even offering advice or giving your side of the story, but just about holding space for that person so they can do whatever they need to do and feel seen and feel heard and feel held, really.
And how can somebody be expected to do that for another person when they haven't done their own work? It's almost unfair in a way, because you never know what kind of triggering things are going to come up in an experience, particularly on medicine. And so somebody that hasn't done their own work, I would be uncomfortable having someone hold space for me that hadn't done their own work. The beauty of things like this podcast about, I guess, the internet in general, is that there's so much more opportunity to learn about these things, either from the science background or these anecdotal experiences or videos or what have you, that we can learn about this en masse in a way that never before in human history have we been able to do. And we're in each conversation moving this needle forward a little bit more and a little bit more to put more and more and more people in a position, not even to do medicine work, but as you say, Shalice, just to hold space for other people, to hear that term and that messaging coming up over and over and over again, so that it starts to sink in. Oh, if I want to hold space for somebody, maybe there's some things I need to do first, or this opportunity has come up. Oh, this is what holding space is. I remember hearing something about that. Blows my mind how readily available this information is and how many people are being helped. Who knows for how long from now, somebody sitting down listening to this episode 5 years from now might pull some nugget out of this that's going to end up helping them and helping somebody else. Love it. Blows my mind.
Oh, guys, I love this.
Well, we probably got to end it on that, but I just got to say big ups to, yes, Peter's wife, props to Shalice's future wolf husband, mate. That's a deep cut, by the way. That's a deep cut to say Shalice's, yeah, future wolf husband. Big ups to Audrey, which we can now say her, yeah, name. I think that's what I heard, is I can say her name. Big ups to my, you know, we don't talk about my wife much because she wants to remain, you know, away from this. But one of the things she always talks about is like, I don't know what you guys are trying to find. Just, yeah, it's here. You know, Mike, you've had that experience where we've, you know, she'll trip with us and stuff like that. She didn't get as into it as you and I do or anything like that. But she's like, I don't know what you guys are trying to find. It's here right now. And I'm just like, fuck you for having it so easily come to you.
Oh,
you
know? I love her, man.
But I can't help it. She's awesome. So big ups to those people who put up with our needing to dig deeper, you know, like, yes, thank totally. You. If you're listening.
And ourselves you. For doing the work.
Oh yeah, way props to ourselves. That goes without saying. I'm just saying, like, good on them.
And you know? Peter, I just want to say thank you. Oh. I mean, you coming not only for these episodes and these wisdom, we need to get you on so much more because this is amazing. But also just your help. I mean, you came at the perfect time to help behind the scenes, and I know, you know, Doug and I, it gets a little overwhelming for us, and. I always love when, you know, we have our meetings, Peter, and you just challenge us, but then you also just help lighten the load of it all. And I just appreciate you, man. Thank you.
Thank you. It is so much fun. I mean, the people that have popped out of the woodwork, even since I started getting involved, the artists and musicians and people in the community, just it really took to heart that message of it's time to bring the people together. Like, that sticks with me. And I mentioned it to other people that I've worked with now, that there is no substitute for a group of people pointing in the same direction. We can do some work ourselves, but there is an amplification of all this work when a bunch of people are doing it from a genuine space of wanting to do good work, of wanting to do it in community, not doing it for money or ego gratification or anything like that, just because it's like the right thing to do. That's what brought me here. And as long as that's the case, I'm happy to stick around. It's a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. Yeah. I love that.
Amazing. Yes.
I love you three so much. Thank you for this. I mean, I could give thanks for another 45 minutes. We're already an hour and 45 minutes into this, but Shalice, we kind of bragged about you in the last episode. We did an episode, just the two, me and Mike, and we talked about you just because you're like this, you're like a, you know, no offense, but if Jesus wanted you for a sunbeam, he got more than he wanted with you.
You know? That's sweet. Thank
and
you.
And Peter, to echo what Mike said, like, without giving him, so in my professional life, I have to worry about the well-being and the lives of 30,000 people. And I have to worry about it in detail and minutia and all that kind of stuff. And so, Peter, you've seen, we've had like what we would call, I guess, like business meetings or whatever.
Yep.
You've seen that I'm an airhead. I mean, I'm just, my head's in the clouds about that stuff. But that's because this space is the place that I allow for myself to do that and to be that. And it needs a counterbalance. And you've just been, I mean, I don't know if I'm talking about like you've been a godsend or a Zeus send or a
send,
Allah send or a Pleiadian send or an Anunnaki send, but whoever is rolling, you were sent by them. So thank you to you and thank you to them. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank and Mike, you. I love you. I say that enough, so I love you.
I still love hearing it.
so much love for everybody. Yeah.
I love saying it. Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right.
Much love.
Let's call it an episode.
Yay. Thanks, guys. Love you.
I got to pee right now, so this is perfect timing.
All right. Okay, bye, guys. Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to Mormons on Mushrooms podcast. We have so much fun recording it. And if you love it, we would absolutely love it if you could leave a review on wherever you get your podcasts. It would really help our visibility so more people can listen to it and be enlightened and hear our crazy stories. So thanks again for tuning in.